this morning is a talk and then some silent reflections on our own. And then this afternoon is an opportunity to come together with others, a bit more of a discussion arena. So if you're interested in being in a discussion group, come to the Shrine Tent this afternoon. I just wanted to say a couple of words about the lovely Badra Devi. So I first got to know Badra Devi on my ordination retreat. She was part of the support team. And I think there's something really interesting about ordination retreats, because you're just there getting ordained in your own sort of wonderful little world. And I don't think you always quite realise there's an awful lot going on behind the scenes to sort of make that happen. And Badra Devi was one of those people who just got on with whatever needed doing. So I always feel really grateful to you, Badra Devi. That's that sense of somebody really holding the space for you on retreat to really do what it is that you need to be doing. And then I think you really live and exemplify your name, actually. I think there's that real Vajra quality of searching and looking for the truth. And actually, it's not too unpointed and hard. It's got the Devi qualities of sensitivity and subtlety. So I think there's a sort of real sense of you embodying and living out your name. So I'm really, really delighted to give this talk, and hand over to you.
Thank you. Let me know, please, if my voice drops and you stop being able to hear me. It's funny, when somebody's introducing me, I often get it sparks off my own memories and associations of them. And I think I've told you this, Suchimani, but at Il Convento, Suchimani impressed me because she wore these really sort of brief Saturday nighties.
She wandered around the corridors of
Il
Convento in these pretty little
90s. I wore an old t-shirt today. So this was a bit of a teaching for me, femininity. So that memory arose again. This talk has been quite something for me, quite an unusual process or non-process of seeming to have lots and lots of diverse things stretching back to the original sort of what triggered me in India to think, I've got an idea, of something I'd like to say, to then needing to come up with a brief sort of synopsis which happened quite quickly, and then needing to come up with a title a bit later. And then when I eventually looked at all those things, thinking, I don't know what they have to do with each other. One of the things I could explain to myself, just because it is a bit of a recent thing, is some of you will know, I have chronic migraine. And recently I saw a top neurologist in London, really, really lovely guy. And he talked about migraine as an overexcitable brain. Mm-hmm. And he's given me a great big magnet to sort of zap the back of my head. Mm-hmm. So this may be the talk product of an overexcitable brain. Maybe next time I give a talk, it'll all be calm. Magnetized brain. So we'll see. So, living a life for the Dharma, what is it we're doing with our one wild and precious life? So I just wanted to start with a moment, in fact I would probably refer to several moments from the time in India. I was there for the retreat as well as the order convention, the order retreat. And one of the things that happened on the order retreat was a coming together of if the magic of being at the Mahabodhi Temple, the magic of being with the order, the international order, the international Sangha, actually, because on this particular evening there were a number of mitras there who were on pilgrimage, so that we'd sort of congregated around, as we did each evening at the Mahabodhi Temple. We were doing a puja, and there was also a magic happening in nature that evening. So I don't think it amounted to very much over here, but in India it was a super blue full blood moon. So it was the second full moon in the month. It's a blue moon. It was a full moon. It was a blood moon. I forget the terminology. Anyway, it was very, very big. It was super moon. That was a super bit. That's right. And the blood moon was because there was a total eclipse of the moon. And during us doing a seven pole puja, we went from having a completely black sky to the left of the Mahabodhi temple. As we did the puja, the moon was gradually uncovered, so by the end it was almost full, and by the time we left the temple grounds it was you've gone from nothing. So this sort of magic in nature, and to me there's just the significance of it all coming together, and it did remind me, I suppose, of the sort of more mythic significance that we give to the happenings around the Buddha's enlightenment at the Bodhi tree at the Mahabodhi temple. So I was so excited about this, but actually in itself it was just this real coming together of conditions. And one of my thoughts was that we're all here because of Bhante. This international Sangha that has come about because of him, because of his vision. So I wanted to dedicate this talk to Bhante as an offering to him. And I entitled it after his talk, that some of you in this room I think were probably in Birmingham in 1999 when he gave a talk, A Life for the Dharma. It was about Atisha. He was talking about the great Buddhist Atisha, who came up yesterday, didn't he, in the talks. And Bhante was talking about Atisha as having giving his life for the Dharma. And I very clearly had the thought how Bhante is also one of those great Buddhists. He's also given his life for the Dharma. So I felt a lot of love, a lot of gratitude to him for teaching us the Dharma, for teaching us the tools for transformation, and not just the tools but the spirit, teaching us the spirit of the Dharma. So the second part of the title will be familiar to many of you from a Mary Oliver poem, What Is It We're Doing With Our One Wild and Precious Life. So just tell you a bit of what I hope to be talking about. Quite diverse strands. So I want to talk about three C's, and they're not the usual ones, the communities, centres and team-based right livelihoods. C word. So I want to talk about conditions, conditioning and conditionality. Pratitya Samuppada. And hopefully explore some ways in which, through deepening our understanding of Pratitya Samuppada, through being more aware, more conscious of our conditions and our conditioning. But I'd also like to talk about just some feelings and reflections I had whilst in India and looking back on that time in India. Some of the stories I heard about some of the Indian order members in particular, and the sense I had of what it meant to be in an international Sangha, an intercultural movement, and something about living a wild and precious life for the Dharma. You can maybe get a sense of the the overexcited brain that goes in lots of different directions. So I want to start with a story that I heard quite a while before I went to India. It was something I saw on Facebook. It was a little film, and it was quite distressing, so I warn you in advance. It was posted by an Indian order member, and it was a little video showing a dead young man, and he'd been beaten. He'd been beaten to death, and there were lots of crying, lots of wailing, and pulling off his clothes so you could see the bruising on his body. It was very strong. And the Indian order member had posted below. He said, "How many more of us have to die before something changes?" And what it was is this young man had a dispute with his neighbour, and he'd gone to the police, and he had died in police custody in this way. So the despair and the anger voiced by this member of our order, member of our Sangha, was found very strong. And the fact that he was saying it's not an isolated incident, it's something that happens many, many times a year in the Dalit community, the ex-untouchable community. So there's no recourse to the law, there's no sort of safety, if you like, within the law for that community. So, I was left with this for quite a long time, long after the Facebook sort of feed had moved on. I was left with these images and his desperate words in my mind. What could I do? I didn't do anything. I didn't know what to do. But I think it obviously had the sense that this is someone from my community. This is my order brother who's talking about his life, showing me something about his life and the conditions under which he lives. So in India, on the retreat and the convention, there were a lot of Indian speakers, and I heard a lot about, through their talks, about the dangers and the difficulties, the injustices and the inequalities for a Dalit, a new Buddhist, an order member in their daily life. So their life involves a lot of unfairness and a lot of risk. Obviously, that is not the whole story, but that element is there quite strongly. Because what I also heard was a huge amount of joy to be practicing the Dharma, gratitude to Bhante, to Dr. Ambedkar, to the Buddha. A lot of devotion expressed, and a real motivation to give that came through both the difficulty of the conditions, the adversity of the conditions, and the gratitude, the joy. And I think something that's a bit different in India, I realised, is that there are millions and millions of Dalits, ex-untouchables, and if you like, the order in India have a really natural expression of their generosity just by extending it towards their own community. I think there's a lot of motivation to extend it towards their own community. And it's just very natural. There's a very strong need. So what I was thinking was that we have to look often outside our own community. Not necessarily, sometimes within the order, and we have lots of ways of giving, but in terms of to know that level of dukkha, I think sometimes it can become other, the homeless, the poor, And actually, I think in India, the opportunity is slightly different. It's a much more natural expression within the sort of hugeness of the community. So much of the work of the Indian Tri Ratna community is aimed at raising the quality of the lives of the Dalit people through social work, educational work, legal aid groups, and ultimately aiming at Dharma work, complete transformation of the whole being. Yeah, so we talk about having good conditions, conditions that are helpful to spiritual life and that support our practice. And I think the difference in conditions between India and sort of particularly the Western countries, yeah, it's obviously very different. And we have a democracy that is not perfect, but I think the caste system is just really something else. When I first wrote this, I put the caste system is evil, and I didn't really want to say that, but something else doesn't quite do it justice. I think it's dangerous, it's deeply harmful, and deeply, deeply ingrained. Even though it's been illegal for, I don't know, 60 years or something, it's sort of deeply ingrained. And one of the talks we heard there was from an Indian Dharmacharini, I'm pretty sure her name is Amita Mati, who is a doctor in India. And during her talk, she was talking about, you know, various promotions that she'd had. And she'd been promoted to quite a high level, and she was managing quite a number of people. I don't know, maybe 20 people or something within her role in, I think, public health or something. And I found myself thinking while she was talking, well, okay, so, you know, okay, so there is the caste system, but, you know, obviously, you can make progress, you can sort of have a good life too. And then she carried on talking, and yeah, actually you can do well in some ways, but these people that she was managing, quite a lot of them did not want to work with her because she was a Dalit. Some of them agitated to get her moved out of their office to somewhere else. Yeah, they resisted her management. So there are a lot of different ways in which it was still having a huge effect on her life. Yeah, just by virtue of her birth, her caste. So the concept of being someone being unclean or someone polluting is quite an alien concept, I think, to us, but in India, that's what's deeply ingrained, really deeply ingrained. And yeah. So one of the moments for me in Bodh Gaya was hearing another talk, I think on the retreat, and this was a talk about the Buddha's meeting with a Brahmin. As he sat under, well, he sat integrating his enlightenment at the Ajapala Nigrodha tree, which is part of the Mahabodhi complex, the goat herd banyan tree. So there's this sort of marble pillar there, depicting different sort of events that are found in different suttas in the Buddha's, those few weeks after his enlightenment. So this Brahmin, very strange. Brahmin was called Huhanka, Brahmin Huhanka, and he was named after his haughty and wrathful demeanour. And this haughty, wrathful demeanour manifested by him going around saying ho hum, or occasionally ho ho. So ho ho. I think it must be all in how you say it, how much you turn your nose down. So anyway, he asked the Buddha, what is a true Brahmin? And I think he was anticipating some sort of affirmation, some sort of he himself was a Brahmin. So what's a true Brahmin? So the Buddha's reply is encapsulated in one of these signposts, marking the spot, and it says, "Only by one's deeds one becomes a Brahmin, not by one's birth." I found this incredibly moving. Actually, this hearing about the lives of the Indian order members and how much of the difficulties were because of caste. And at the sight of his enlightenment, the Buddha stands for worth, not birth. Stands in solidarity with our Indian brothers and sisters, stands in solidarity with the order, with the principles of the order. So I want to say a little bit about this worth not birth in relation to us, and maybe in relation to one or two other sanghas. So I think the Theravada, my experience of it in the East and the West, modern day Theravada actually, is to some extent based on birth. Particularly if you're a man, then you're privileged. Monks are privileged in both the Theravada in the East and the Theravada in the West. So you might think, well, isn't that in line with what the Buddha set up? So I wanted to mention, and this is an aside, but I think it's quite an important aside, to make a distinction between modern day Theravada and early Buddhism, because there's a whole field of research that some of you, I imagine, are well aware of, research looking at the place of women in early Buddhism, and this is including Anālio. It's one of the main fields of his research. So it's now thought by many scholars and scholar practitioners that there are a lot of events that don't put women in a particularly good light, reported in the Pali Canon, that didn't happen, but are later insertions into the canon, and quite likely for cultural or economic reasons. There were limited resources, and so there was an incentive, if you like, for the monks to sort of keep getting fed as much as anything else, to have a higher status. So Anālio, I think the paper that he writes about this in is Women in Early Buddhism, if you're interested. So I just want to give a...
What was the name, Dean?
I think it's called Women in Early Buddhism.
Thank you.
So a couple of examples. I think in recent years, scholars have been able to look at all the writings, or all the writings they have access to, and come up with a chronology, a much clearer chronology. The Pali Canon is not written in the order in which events are thought to have happened. It's a little bit all over the place. So there's a great big project that's happened to put things as best as scholars can work out in the order that they happened. And knowing the timeline has changed how we see some of these events. For example, the whole story around Ananda interceding on behalf of Maha Prajapati to ask the Buddha to allow women to enter the order. According to the chronology, Ananda was 8 years old at the time this is said to have happened. So it really, really puts it into doubt whether it actually happened. So that's one thing. Another thing is, I suppose, the doubt around the question whether the Buddha intended there to be nuns. It can come across as if he was sort of, his mind was a bit, he had to be persuaded of that. But again, if when the chronology is there, what comes up again and again is the idea of a fourfold assembly, a fourfold sangha. And sometimes it's in the phrase of monks, nuns, laymen and laywomen. So it makes it much more likely that the intention was always there, or there from a very early time, that it be a fourfold sangha and not a threefold sangha. So I find this research very encouraging, actually, very confidence-giving. And I think it's important for us. Otherwise, I find in myself, I've had to do a bit of contorting around, why might the Buddha have not wanted to have nuns? Why did he have to be persuaded? And all these sorts of things. Actually, you know, perhaps it wasn't like that. Perhaps it was different. So again, the Buddha perhaps being more interested in worth than birth. So another way in which sometimes this birth, not worth, comes up is in terms of seniority. And I don't want to be seen to be picking on the Theravada. It's partly that I know more about that tradition than I do about the Tibetan tradition. But I have a good friend who was a nun for a long time in that tradition. And she described that even if someone is ordained 5 minutes before you, you are senior. No, sorry, they are senior to you. And one of the ways that shows is that you line up. Whenever you go anywhere, say on the arms round or queuing up for meals, you line up on the basis of seniority. I don't think that would go down very well with us. But I think for us, I think pretty much consistently we're based on worth, not birth. I think our spiritual hierarchy is based on the spiritual maturity, the spiritual qualities that manifest. And often they manifest particularly strongly in our elders. But that's not the criteria. The criteria is not being an elder. The criteria is to the extent that those qualities are manifesting, the wisdom, the qualities of wisdom, the qualities of compassion are manifesting. So I think there's a direct line between that marble signpost and how our order is set up, how Bhante set it up. And also a direct line between that and how we relate to each other. And I think it encourages us to be really open to each other and see and appreciate each other's qualities. So I was talking about spiritual receptivity yesterday, and I think this is one of the ways in which it can manifest, is that real openness to each other's qualities. So just briefly back to that Facebook video, what more can I do? And I think often those feelings for me can arise with a certain amount of hopelessness or guilt or inertia. This, what can I do? And then I don't know, so then sometimes those feelings can arise. So what I didn't want to do was to sort of, in a way, use the difference in between India and between us to in a way that would evoke those sorts of feelings. I really, really don't want to do that. Rather than comparing conditions for practice, I wanted to think about for myself what I could learn just through having a different set of conditions sort of reflected back at me, through seeing more clearly what the Indian order members are up against. How could I reflect further about my own conditions, my own conditionings, and use those reflections to deepen the understanding of Paticca-samuppada. And this is without denying the relative ease and the advantages of my conditions. So I want to make a couple of points. possibly three if I have time. So the first one, remembering that anything can happen at any time. Remembering that anything can happen at any time. So perhaps everybody here, I'm not sure about everybody, but yeah, we live in a temperate climate, not extreme on the whole, not dangerous on the whole. Sometimes describe it as a mild, damp little island. I'm very fond of. On the whole, we have plentiful food, clothing. We have unprecedented peace and stability, and we've had that. I think it's almost as long a period in. I don't have to say this. There's almost never been such a long period in history where there's been this degree of stability fought for us in Britain, even though we have engaged in wars on other shores. It's I think 73 years since the end of the Second World War, where in a sense we were certainly invaded by air. So, you know, so in that period there's been this stability, great stability. And during that time we built up safety nets in society through the welfare services, the health services, and that they are perhaps not enough, not good enough, and they have been greatly diminished over recent years. But there's something there if I get sick or if I can't work. But all this can change very fast. Who would have thought 2 years ago that we would be just on a sort of more of a macro level that we would be leaving Europe? Who would have thought that we would have there would be a reality TV businessman in office, the highest office in the US. Big shocks. And yet, there were conditions. There were conditions that led up to those events. They didn't arise out of nothing. So this, I think, is an example of where change seemed very fast or very sudden. But actually, I think those changes seem that way because I'm not bearing in mind impermanence. I'm not bearing in mind much smaller changes that are happening along the way. And of course, not just world events, but personal change. Something coming at me that I don't expect, that throws me. Shock, surprise, disbelief. Not understanding how that could have happened. And some degree of aversion, often, towards those things. So, admittedly, often in retrospect, I find these moments interesting. But I think they give me a glimpse of how deep or not is my understanding of cause and effect. With the strong reactions, there's not very much understanding of that there were conditions in place that led to this particular result. And sometimes there's a bit more understanding, there's a bit more equanimity. Even if I can see how disastrous perhaps it's going to be on a world scale, there can still be a level of being able to, okay, this has arisen on the basis of causes and conditions. I find it interesting and reassuring that we don't need to understand all the conditions leading to a particular event. And the Buddha said it wasn't possible to do that. It's far too subtle, far too complex. So we don't need to understand all the conditions to just have the understanding that things rise in dependence upon conditions. So we can use our knowledge of conditionality to investigate our reactions to wherever we see them, actually, wherever we see something that we're surprised by or don't understand or where there's any outrage or disappointment or a very firm view about something. So the author, Margaret Atwood, Canadian author, the author of The Handmaid's Tale, which I think I read in the 80s and probably many of you did too, 80s or 90s. So when this book was published in the 80s or 90s, she was accused of going too far in her portrayal. For those of you that don't know anything about the book or the TV series, it's a tale of a dystopian world where there are very few fertile women left. And so they're used as sexual slaves to the ruling religious class. And very interesting. People complained. They said it could never happen. It could never happen. So she said two things in response to this. She said she hadn't put anything in the book that hadn't already happened in the world. She'd stayed within what was known. So the conditions had already led up to the events that she's portrayed. And then the second thing she said, I was born in 1939, so I know that anything can happen at any time. So this anything can happen at any time has become something of a mantra for me. And not as an attempt, not wanting to destabilise necessarily or unnecessarily, but just to try and live my life with a bit more awareness of the conditions that keep my life the way it is and how they can change. So the first of the questions, or the sort of areas for possible reflection, I will write it up there, but reflecting on any conditions in your life or in the world more broadly, reflecting if those conditions changed, maybe just one or two conditions changed, what would that mean? How different would your circumstances be then? For me, I was thinking, well, my partner is currently supporting me. Someone put to me a couple of years ago, how does it feel to be a kept woman? And I said this to my partner, and he said, well, you seem to quite enjoy it. Yeah. So if we split up, if he died, if he got sick and couldn't work, and also it's not a long-term arrangement we have, it's at the moment. But there'd be a whole series of cause and effects. I would need to get a paying job. I don't have a lot of qualifications, so it would be quite a low-pay job. Probably put quite a lot of strain on my already not that great health. I wouldn't be able to do very much in the way of teaching or writing, things that really feed my practice and hopefully also offer something to others. So there are other consequences. I mean, there are lots and lots of consequences, but I think it's worth. Well, it brings up a lot of gratitude. I regularly express my gratitude to him, but it's just really good to sort of stay in touch with the how I benefit from certain conditions and how easily those conditions could change. There was a saying during the last recession, a popular saying in the U.S. The average American is only two paychecks away from living in their car. This says quite a lot, really. It can take so little time to fall away from the dream, the dream that most of us live. Yeah. So next birth, we might be a Rohingya orphan. But even later in this life, things can change very, very quickly. I've been reading a book by someone called Atul Gawande. I think some of you, yeah, a few nods. Being Mortal. And he writes about, very, very beautifully, about aging. Lots and lots of things I won't go into. But that he describes being with a gerontologist. who's with a patient who's got a couple of quite serious issues. I think one of them is a dicky heart. And the gerontologist, the surgeon, Atul Gawande is a surgeon, he is surprised that this gerontologist spends so much time on really quite minor aspects of this woman's health. He asks her about her feet. He asks her if she can reach her feet. He gets her to take her shoes and socks off to see if she can reach her feet, to see if she's able to... Anyway, and he also asks her about her diet. And Atul Gawande is quite puzzled by this, and he speaks to the surgeon about it afterwards and says, well, what about her heart? And what about this other big thing? And the gerontologist says, well, if she can't reach her feet, she can't clean her feet, she's more likely to get abscesses, she's more likely to get rubbing and blisters, as she's more likely to get infections, affect her whole body. She's also more likely to fall over. And as an older person, once you've fallen over, the effects, they're very well documented, the effects on mobility and independence and being able to live an independent life. And similarly with diet, he was asking if she was able to look after herself, because if she's no longer able to cook for herself, then her diet goes downhill, her strength goes downhill, and you need strength to support your frame, again, so you don't fall over. So they were really simple things, but this gerontologist really saw the consequences of these quite small things, whereas the surgeon was sort of homing in on the major things that could be fixed. But yeah, both are important, but actually for her continued quality of life and independence, rather than just sort of fixing something major, the gerontologist had a better understanding. And it reminded me a bit of what Bhante said. He thought a lot about death, but not a lot about ageing. Yeah. So time is going on. Cool. So my second point is, Martin Luther King, and this quote came from him, he says, let us develop a dangerous kind of unselfishness. Let us develop a dangerous kind of unselfishness. Yeah. So one thing very obvious in India is the standard of living, very different standard of living to us, and it's so obvious. But I'm saying it just because I think it can be important to not overlook its significance. Many years ago, when I was fundraising for Aranya, the Aranya project, we did a series of money workshops, and one of the things that often happened was that people in the group would go around and talk about what we were worth financially. And it was, you know, this could be, you know, houses that you owned, inheritances that you had, the money that you earned from your job, or not. And it was very interesting that sometimes people who seemed to have quite a lot felt poor, and other people who seemed to not have very much at all didn't feel poor. So it's very, very subjective. And so worth looking at, being interested in our conditioning around money, where we get tight, or resources, where we get tight, where we have a more open hand. And I think it's worth looking at, if you like, the arbitrary nature of where all this has come from, what we've got or what we don't. It is quite arbitrary when you think that 4 out of 5 niyamas are sort of out of our control. You know, we have control over our sort of karmic, the karma niyama, But the others, there's a lot more sort of randomness, if you like. So I think sometimes if I see what I have as in some ways quite arbitrary conditions that I've sort of lucked into, rather than, I think this can work against a feeling of entitlement or a feeling that, oh, I work for this, I deserve this, which I think actually contributes to quite a strong sense of self. It's a sort of clenching around something. I think if we can see that, if we can bear in mind not only the arbitrary nature of the conditions we have, but the bedrock of good conditions that we rest on, just through the society that we've been born into. Until recently, you know, free education to university level. Lots and lots of things that are a sort of bedrock. Somebody else may work very, very, very hard too, but they don't have access to those benefits in India or in Africa, say. So I think that this can help with a letting go of that sort of tightness around me and mine, you know, my skills, my resources, my time. The Burmese teacher Sayadaw Utejaniya says, in this little phrase, and it says, "The mind is not yours, but you are responsible for it." And I think it's similar for resources, skills, talents. They're not ours, but we can take responsibility for using them well. We can be custodians for a brief lifespan, custodians of what we have and use it well. Our wild, precious life resources. What's the best way of using them now and after our death? Another little story, the Facebook co-founder or a big investor in Facebook, he made $500 million in 3 years. Can you imagine? It's a huge, huge amount of money. Did he deserve it? He didn't actually do anything for it, except he had a lot of money, or he had a bit of money to invest. Did he deserve it? Well, he didn't really think so. His own opinion was nobody deserves to have that much money. Mm-hmm. Which I found quite refreshing, actually, quite refreshing. And he's now part of a movement, no doubt full of complexity and double standards and lots of compromises, but he's part of a movement to institute a universal wage. That's his response to having more money than he needs or deserves. So second question, when and in what conditions do you notice an extended hand, a closed hand in relation to your resources? And how do both feel? This is not about judging. This is about noticing what conduces to suffering and what conduces to freedom. So, and explore perhaps any views around what you feel you are entitled to or what you feel you deserve. So I wanted to talk very briefly, I'm editing as I go, this third area, which is about noticing expectations, which I think is related to entitlement. So I wanted to talk, just in India, I think the expectations, you see a lot of external expectations, a lot of sort of cultural traditions, expectations, things that is very, very difficult for Indian order members to not do. And the main one, I think, for the Dharmacharinis is if they don't want to get married. It's really difficult. Hard for us to imagine, I think, not having that sort of freedom over a choice in your life. So I think for me, and I think for a lot of the non-Indians I was with at the convention, I think India is quite a good place to spot various sort of expectations you have. A more internal, more sort of watching our minds, watching, seeing what comes up in the mind. I was on a train journey with several others that ended up being 20 hours late. I know Sada Hadaya and Suchi Mani were on almost a parallel train journey that was also 24 hours late, I think. Yeah. And so that sort of thing. What does your mind do with that? Actually, sometimes when you're away from home, you're more able to laugh at it, I think. Maybe it's the smaller things that happen closer to home that are more difficult to deal with. There was something else on the convention that caused a little bit of sort of a range from puzzlement to outrage, and that was that the food was labelled. So there was spicy food, which was very clear. There was a line for you could spicy food, and then there was non-spicy food. They tasted the same. Then there was zero spicy food, which was yogurt and white bread. All those eggs, I think. White food. So that sort of thing. So I think expectations are often allied with craving. They're allied with our wants in a situation. And I think from the perspective of Pratichit Samuppada, things don't happen because we want them to. Things happen because the causes and conditions support them coming into being. So I think where a deeper understanding of Pratichit Samuppada comes in is it's a direct cause of a release of craving, or craving not arising, and therefore a lack of suffering, a lessening in suffering. I can see a couple of you looking slightly puzzled, so I'm just going to repeat that. So things don't happen because we want them to, but because the causes and conditions support their arising or not. So the third question, or the third area for exploration, can you get interested in noticing your own expectations or your wants from any situation? Notice any views linked to the expectation. And again, without judging, it's just about being interested. It's about noticing. So I want to finish just by saying a little bit about living a life for the Dharma. I think probably many of us will have different ways of expressing this, but one of the ways that works for me is the quality of sampajana or samprajanya, and particularly the quality of sati samprajanya, so mindfulness and clearly knowing or clearly comprehending. So you might think, well, what has this got to do with living a life for the Dharma? But Bhante brings out particularly the dimension of purpose, of continuity of purpose. So we clearly know what we're doing and we understand its overall relationship to our spiritual life. We understand whether what we're doing or what we're thinking is helpful or not on the path. So that continuity of purpose, we can tune into our direct experience. We can watch our minds and our hearts and get a sense of, is this in line with my Dharma purpose or not? And again, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. And I think that's the learning of the spiritual life. So I see it sometimes as a spiritual rudder. It's like a little boat, and sometimes I can really feel that rudder is guiding me, guiding sort of me through particular currents of a spiritual life. And sometimes I see it like a spiritual compass, so pointing north, or orienting, can I orient, can I be oriented back to north from northeast, or worst case scenario, south? So living a life of the Dharma, I think we have to accept both being in harmony and being where we're deviating from the path. Not set up some sort of struggle or conflict around that, but allow there to be relaxation around that, so that we can see more clearly and move, take steps back. So Bhante's life has a strong current of the Dharma through him and beyond him to us. And he's lived a life of the Dharma, but clearly also his own wild and precious life. If such a thing were possible, not a generic Dharma life. He's not. He's had his own sort of passions, his own loves, his poetry, his Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2, encompassing India and encompassing the West. It's encompassed passions and controversies and brilliance. And he hasn't got it all right, I don't think. But neither have we. And I don't think, personally, I don't expect him to get it all right. But we have through him this worldwide order. And when I was writing my talk, I kept thinking about a one Sangha. I don't know why that A is important, but it is. Not just one Sangha, a one Sangha. Very different conditions for practice, an international Sangha, and the taste of that was really, really strong in Bodh Gaya. So in a roundabout way, talked about trying to recognise the conditions in which we practice and seeing how they have conditioned us, or they continue to condition us positively. I think we're learning not to be defined by our conditions, and learning not to be identified with our conditioning. And more as we look through this lens, if you like, of Pratitya Samuppada, we'll be able to be free to live our lives for the Dharma, and live them in our own wild and precious way, our unique wild and precious way. Individually, but also collectively, partly through our thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. Yes, I thought something was nibbling. Yeah. So I was going to finish with another moment, but I think I won't. I think I'll leave it there because that's plenty.